The next talk is entitled The Participation of Psychologists in Sexually Violent Predator Evaluations, Public Service or Serving Public Hysteria. Sounds like an interesting topic. Paul Good, PhD, is a clinical and forensic psychologist in private practice in San Francisco and is adjunct assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco. He has treated and assessed sex offenders for many years. Jules Burstein, PhD, is a clinical and forensic psychologist in private practice in Berkeley. He's on the Superior Court panel of psychologists in several Bay Area counties, and for 30 years he has evaluated and treated sex offenders. So let's have a big hand for Drs. Good and Burstein.
I apologize for Jonathan French, who couldn't be with us today. He was going to be a discussant for our panel. He was a former member of the state of California's SVP panel who resigned. But our core message today is that SVP laws in many ways fail to serve the public interest. Our agenda is going to be to start with an analysis of how SVP laws are part of a moral panic and a regressive trend in American culture in which sex offenders, like terrorists, are the new enemies of the state and are causing us to sacrifice civil liberties in the name of security. We're going to talk about SVP civil commitments that are predicated on fictitious mental disorders. Then we'll discuss the use of actuarial risk assessments to assess dangerousness and discuss how these mislead often the trier of fact, juries or judges. And finally, we're going to conclude with a call for psychologists not to support what we see as a corrupt system, a corrupt program, and to abandon their work for these SVP state panels. I'm going to start off and draw your attention to Eric Janis's new book, Failure to Protect, America's Sexual Predator Laws and the Rise of the Preventive State. This is a wonderful little book, and in it, Janis says that SVP laws portend the coming of a preventive state. Let me explain what I mean by that. SVP laws are an exemplar for how society is undoing the constitutional protections of the criminal justice system, the checks and balances that were set up by it. By subjecting individuals to civil commitment in anticipation of the harm that they might do. So under SVP laws, civil commitment is possible without psychosis, which has been the traditional standard. It's possible without imminent dangerousness, which was the traditional standard. And it happens under rules that are much looser and vaguer than the criminal justice system has set up. Let me give you an example. Recently, in 2007, from the state of Virginia, at a civil commitment hearing, the state sought to introduce into evidence the testimony of a victim of alleged sexual offenses, where that victim had previously testified against the defendant in a trial in which he was found not guilty of all the alleged offenses. So in the past, he was found not guilty of the offenses. But in the civil commitment hearing that happened later, the state introduced a victim from that previous offense to talk about what this fellow had done to her. So, of course, the defendant objected to the admissibility of the victim's testimony, citing the doctrine of collateral estoppel as a bar to her testimony. The defendant argued that his not guilty verdict in the previous criminal trial, in which the victim had testified, barred the reintroduction of her testimony at his subsequent SVP hearing. But the SVP trial judge allowed the alleged victim to testify against this defendant, and the defendant raised again the issue of double jeopardy. He said, I was tried for that crime. I was found not guilty. Now you're bringing it up again in my hearing. That's double jeopardy. The trial court was not impressed. So the case was appealed. He was found to be committable as an SVP with an indeterminate sentence sent to the state hospital for the treatment of sex offenders. Well, he appealed the trial court verdict, and the Virginia Supreme Court unanimously affirmed the trial court's decision, arguing that under the evidence rules of criminal trials, the jury in the criminal trial only found him not guilty by a reasonable doubt, and that this left undecided whether he might be guilty by the lesser, clear and convincing standard that is used in the SVP commitment hearings in Virginia. So this is what I mean. We are creating a system, an alternative system, separate from the criminal justice system, with rules that are looser, so that we can essentially implement a social policy. The SVP laws now have made risk or dangerousness the new status that replaces race, gender, sexual orientation as the basis for depriving someone of their rights. The SVP laws do this, Janice says, via an outsider jurisprudence in which sex offenders are vilified and identified as dangerous and civilly committed in an alternate, diminished system of justice. This outsider jurisprudence is reflects the demonization of these sex offenders. Now, in 2005, Gallup did a poll that shows that sex offenders are more feared than terrorists. That's how far the demonization has gone. A good example of this outsider jurisprudence, this other set of laws, is the Jim Crow laws that were established in the late 1800s all the way to 1965 when the Voting Rights Act was passed. But the Jim Crow laws were established to set up a separate but equal protections for African Americans. And we know that it wasn't equal. In restrooms, in buses, in schools, in housing, this Jim Crow law was an alternative system of justice that we decided, or that southern states and border states implemented, as a way of essentially limiting and abusing and repressing blacks. Today, the target is people who are sexually dangerous. Which class of people who are different from us and who we do not like will it be tomorrow? The words of a Minnesota Supreme Court Justice, Alan Page, after doing an SVP hearing. So this is the proverbial slippery slope. What group will be the next to be civilly committed? Perhaps psychologists who dare to publish research findings on the neutral or variable effects of some types of adult child sexual conduct. You remember the brouhaha from that research study that showed that there were varied effects. Dr. Laura got a hold of it, and the Republicans in the Congress called for the heads of the APA, and the APA got pretty scared. You remember Martin Niemöller's quote reminding us of the mistake that the German intellectuals made as the Nazis were coming to power. His quote was, "They came first for the communists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. When they finally came for me, there was no one around to speak up." So before we too are caught up in the dragnet, psychologists should take a stand. SVP laws must be seen for what they are. They're part of the larger and more broadly cultural hysteria that's come from the war on terror. The operating principle of the federal government now is similar to the operating principle of SVP laws. Punishing the wrongdoer is less the goal than preventing a threat from materializing. Torture, rendition, warrantless surveillance, they're all done in the name of gathering information and preventing future harm. Not so much for a misdeed that was already done. In the same way that SVP laws have created fictitious mental disorders and set up kangaroo courts to commit sexual offenders, the government now circumvents the criminal courts by creating a fictitious category, enemy combatant, that it can subject to an alternate but diminished system of justice in these military tribunals, where you don't even get to see the evidence that the prosecutor has against you. The Patriot Act allows preventive detention and the suspension of habeas corpus for any American citizen whom the executive branch deems dangerous. That's the context in which I want to think about what we're doing with this SVP program. Now, Dr. Burstein is going to talk about these fictitious mental disorders.
First of all, let me make a comment about the title, the participation of psychologists in SVP evaluations, public service or serving public hysteria. It may not be clear that what we're doing is urging psychologists to have grave doubts about participating in the panels. The fact of the matter is, and perhaps you've been able to infer this from Paul's initial comments, that he and I participate in such evaluations, but only and always on the side of the defense, because of our grave concerns for the terrible implications of this law. Having said that, let me speak about what I've referred to as fictitious mental disorders, which are another way of my saying the use of labels masquerading as diagnostic categories for mental disorders. I want to suggest that these fictitious mental disorders have been deployed by state legislators and government prosecutors to recruit psychologists, and many have been recruited, to single out sex offenders by depriving them of their freedom after they've served their prison sentences, often very, very long sentences. These individuals are subject to SVP civil proceedings that have historically required the presence of psychotic disorders. The focus on psychotic disorders as a basis for civil commitment historically was intended to reflect two crucial values that Paul and I would like to believe most of us subscribe to. The first is that people with psychotic disorders suffer from gross ruptures in their perception of reality, which has been severely compromised, typically by delusional thinking, command hallucinations, and gross misjudgments of other people's behavior. The second crucial value, reflected in the fact that it's been psychotic disorders that are required to deprive people of their liberty in civil commitments, is that we owe it to such people that we civilly commit to provide them with treatment whether they ask for it or not, hence all of the involuntary commitment laws, because such treatment has a good likelihood of ameliorating their symptoms and their suffering, which would in turn allow them to have at least some improvement in their quality of life. These values, in our judgment, are tortured beyond recognition in the SVP civil commitment process, but by what I'm referring to as the construction of fictitious mental disorders. Consider for a moment that few psychologists would regard a non-psychotic man who shook his infant to death or another who beat his wife so severely that she was hospitalized as suffering from a bona fide mental disorder, justifying civil commitment, unless the person was psychotic. The first might be described as ignorant, sadistic, and cruel, and the second as a vicious batterer. But we now have armies of our colleagues willing to call such men who touch their 8-year-old daughter's vagina or who rape a woman as suffering from an official-sounding mental disorder which has the eventual consequence of depriving such men of their freedom for an unlimited number of years after they have served their prison sentence. How did this happen? First of all, very quickly, the SVP statutes in most states, including our own California, has three components. It used to be that you had to commit two or more sexual crimes. That was reduced recently to one or more. These are almost always rape or child molestation. Second, you have to be judged by one of these people on the panel, or two of them, as suffering from a particular mental disorder or abnormality. And third, that mental disorder or abnormality must be said to presently incline you to the commission of dangerous sexual behavior. We're suggesting that the process of pathologizing obviously harmful sex offenses, nobody disagrees that child molestation and rape are despicable offenses, began with the definition of mental disorder in most SVP statutes, which is as follows. This is the most common definition. Quote, a mental disorder is some type of mental abnormality which involves a congenital or acquired condition affecting the emotional or volitional capacity which predisposes the person to commit sexually violent offenses in a degree constituting such person a menace to the health and safety of others. Long mouthful. This definition and its problematic diagnostic implications became the foundation for Zander's seminal 2005 article, which I heartily recommend to all of you. This is an exquisite piece of scholarly work, called Civil Commitment Without Psychosis, the Law's Reliance on the Weakest Links in Psychodiagnosis. It's a tremendous article. In that article, Zander comprehensively addressed the limitations of particular sexual deviation diagnoses, the so-called paraphilias, as well as difficulties inherent in any definition of mental disorder which includes a volitional component. And here I'd like to comment on that problem first with regard to all of the problems that generate our assertion that these are fictitious mental disorders. The volitional component that's been used to generate these definitions of mental disorders have a glaring concern that's almost self-evident. That is, it asks the question, or it should raise the question, of how can one truly know whether an individual actually suffers from a condition affecting his volitional capacity? That is, how is one to make the critical distinction between an irresistible impulse and an impulse one fails to resist? The first implies an overwhelming inability to control behavior, while the latter suggests a failure of will in a person who could have chosen differently, but yielded to a strong wish, need, craving, or inclination instead. When non-psychotic people, like most of us, say, I couldn't help doing what I did, they most often mean, I didn't exert myself enough to refrain from doing what I did, rather than there was no way I could have acted otherwise. And certainly, this seems to be true of all but the most deranged and typically psychotic sex offenders. That is, it was not by virtue of a mental disorder that clamped down their volitional capacity 100%, as I would contend, but that most rapists and child molesters, the two categories we're focusing on here, decided that they were disinclined to restrain themselves from harming a child or a woman, again, with the exception of psychotic individuals. Anticipating the forensic context and possible misuse of the volitional element in relationship to mental disorders, even the DSM-IV manual in its introductory comments issues the following admonition, which is crucial and ignored by SVP evaluators who work for the state. And it goes as follows, quote, the fact that an individual's presentation meets the criteria for a DSM-IV diagnosis does not carry any implication regarding the individual's degree of control over the behaviors that may be associated with that disorder. Here's the crucial piece. Even when diminished control over one's behavior is a feature of the disorder, having the diagnosis in itself does not demonstrate that a particular person is or was unable to control his or her behavior at a particular time. And that's on page 33 in the introductory comments. This is pretty clear and strong language asserting that diagnosed mental disorders ought not to include convictions about volitional capacity. Now I'd like to move on, speaking as quickly as I can because of limited time, about the two diagnoses the evaluators for the state use most often, pedophilia and paraphilia NOS. The DSM-IV-TR defines two essential features of all paraphilias, which are sexual deviation disorders. One, recurrent, intense, sexually arousing fantasies, sexual urges, or behaviors generally involving non-human objects, the suffering or humiliation of oneself or one's partner, or children or other non-consenting persons that occur over a period of at least 6 months. That's the first criteria. The second, the person has acted on these urges, or the urges or sexual fantasies cause marked distress or interpersonal difficulty. Regarding pedophilia, the specific fantasies, urges, or behaviors, and actually the behaviors will be addressed much more compellingly on Sunday by Bob Hallen, are directed to prepubescent children generally up through the age of 12. While historically this term has been regarded as signifying an exclusive and primary arousal to children, now we have the modifiers exclusive and non-exclusive type, thereby erasing what we would contend is the extremely substantive distinction between the fixated pedophile, who may have a relatively high rate of recidivism, from the regressed child molester, often an incest offender, who has a relatively low rate of recidivism because most of them have a long adult heterosexual history. A second concern regarding the diagnosis of pedophilia, which has been commented on by O'Donoghue, Regev, and Hextrom, is how vague the criteria are for making the diagnosis, observing that terms like recurrent, intense, and even behaviors involving sexual activity with a prepubescent child. You can imagine a teacher touching a child on the shoulder whose mother may interpret that as sexual. That they're too imprecise and undefined enough to easily result in many false positives and false negatives. Further, apart from a record of past offenses, only the individual being evaluated knows the answer to these questions about how intense and recurrent are your fantasies and urges, and obviously self-interest would certainly incline most to deny recurrent and intense fantasies and urges. A third problem with the diagnosis of pedophilia has to do with whether these urges, fantasies, and behaviors cause marked distress or interpersonal difficulty. Certainly, those of us who evaluate and treat sex offenders, like Paul and myself, often feel, as we do, that we wish they experienced this marked distress and upset and interpersonal difficulties, but most often they don't. Finally, with regard to pedophilia, Mosier and Kleinplatz, while clearly condemning sexual contact between adults and children, have argued for the removal of pedophilia from DSM-IV, not wishing to see child molesters trying to use such a diagnosis to mitigate their criminal responsibility. I did it because I was sick. Even the DSM-IV alludes to this concern by stating on page 567, quote, many individuals with these disorders, these being paraphilias, assert that their behavior causes them no distress and that their only problem is social dysfunction as a result of the reactions of others to their behavior. That is, you're a disgusting, perverse child molester. I don't want to see you, but the guy feels fine about it. I want to now quickly move on to paraphilia NOS and describe the sexual deviation disorders that come under that category, which some of you will know includes such exotic disorders as telephone scatologia, making obscene phone calls, necrophilia, those who like having sex with the dead, partialism, exclusive focus on one part of the body, such as foot fetishes, clismophilia, one of the really most exotic, a love of enemas, and urophilia, sometimes known as golden showers. It's difficult to imagine that anyone would consider rapists as belonging to this relatively unusual category of sexual interest, which have in common a certain degree of surprise, confusion, and disgust for most of us. Not that we're not disgusted by rapists, but it's a disgust of a different sort. It's moral disgust rather than the disgust of some of these other more exotic disorders. Of course, there's a perfectly serviceable alternative to this diagnostic chicanery regarding rapists, that is, calling men who rape men who suffer from a mental disorder called paraphilia NOS, and it's in the DSM. It's called V6283. Couldn't be clearer. It's called sexual abuse of an adult, and it's listed as a non-mental disorder, which may be a focus of clinical attention. And it provides two examples, coercion, comma, rape. It's hard to imagine that anybody could mistake that the DSM is essentially saying there may be people who rape, and it is a problem for society, and they are going to be punished by it for it, but it's not the result of a mental disorder. Of course, this diagnosis would not satisfy the need for a true mental disorder, this V-code. Quite simply, it describes violative, harmful behavior that's a function of human beings' ubiquitous capacity for the commission of evil acts. Second, with regard to using paraphilia NOS to have rapists put away, the inter-rater reliability for paraphilia NOS is poor. Jill Levinson looked at evaluations of 295 sex offenders who were evaluated by two independent psychologists or psychiatrists to determine whether they should be civilly committed as SVPs. She found an inter-rater reliability coefficient of 0.36, generally considered poor, where what is much more desirable is a reliability coefficient of 0.6 to 0.8. One last consideration of paraphilia NOS derives from the work of Dennis Doran, a psychologist who's the director of evaluations for Wisconsin's SVP commitment program. He's come up with a new diagnosis getting a lot of attention these days called paraphilia NOS non-consent, which he asserts would include not all rapists, but just a relatively small subset of what he calls paraphilic rapists who would then satisfy the criteria for suffering from a bona fide mental disorder. You might ask his criteria. He identifies 9 behaviors which demonstrate the presence of this new diagnosis while neglecting to clarify whether 1, several, or all 9 are necessary. Let me just give 2, which make very little sense to me. The first is 1. This criteria 1 for a paraphilic rather than an ordinary run-of-the-mill rapist. Ejaculation or other clear signs of arousal during events that are clearly non-consensual. And I threw up my hands and wondered, wouldn't this be true of any completed rape where rape is defined as forced penetration and the rapist ejaculates? Second, this is not in order, but it's 2 of his 9. Quote, virtually all of the person's criminal behavior is sexual. Close quote. This makes no sense to me. It suggests that the man who burglarizes 2 homes on 2 separate occasions and opportunistically rapes the women he discovers there is a regular rapist, when the man who simply rapes 2 women on 2 separate occasions because he has no non-sexual crimes is a paraphilic rapist. I'll stop here and allow Paul to continue.
A person is found a sexually violent predator if they are likely to reoffend in the future. In other words, if there's a probability that they will commit a future sexual offense. There are 3 significant problems with the use of actuarial risk assessment instruments to predict that future offense. First, we come to actuarials after disenchantment with the clinical assessment of dangerous, which was found by Monahan in the 80s to only be accurate in 1 of 3 predictions. So actuarials were developed to take out some of the biases from clinical judgment and are an improvement in terms of improved accuracy and also in terms of transparency. You can see what variables the prediction is based on, in no ambiguity, unlike clinical assessments sometimes. The problem is that there is no consensus on what constitutes an adequate level of predictive validity in risk assessment. In other words, the selection, what is the level that we're going to use as a threshold to say that a person is a danger or is enough of a danger that we should deprive them of their liberty. It's not really a statistical decision, but more an ethical and a moral value judgment. It's a judgment that has to weigh the economic and the human costs associated with false positives and false negatives. A second problem with actuarial assessment is that they've really not developed far enough to include dynamic and protective factors. These are protective factors that reduce the likelihood of a person offending in the future. We don't see in these SVP evaluations evaluators incorporating enough in terms of this dimension. The most significant example is age. Age, of course, is going to be a terribly important intervening variable in terms of the risk. Most of the guys that come through for civil commitment who have already served long sentences are in their late 40s, 50s, sometimes even older. The probability estimates that were developed for some of these risk assessment instruments were generally developed on guys who were released in their mid-30s. And they were followed for 5, 10, 15 years, so that the window of opportunity for the validation samples was between 35 and 50, that range. Now here we get guys coming to us for evaluations who are in their 50s, and their 15-year window is through 65. So you can see that somehow the age factor has not really been incorporated. The final thing I want to say about the problems with actuarials is that we're looking at group versus individual dimensions. The probability estimates come from the validation sample, thousands of offenders. A certain percentage of them reoffended. A certain percentage did not. Now an individual comes before the SVP trial court and is said to have a certain probability of reoffending. But the fact is that the SVP evaluators don't know the specific probability for this particular individual. They may know that he is like a group which had a 52% probability of reoffending, but we don't know if he is one from the 52% or whether he's one of the 48% that didn't reoffend. So when you go from group estimates and attribute that risk to an individual within that group, you're on shaky ground. Janice and Prentke, who have affirmed using actuarials because they are better than clinical judgment, still say that even if they were perfect, we would still not support them because they would be ethically and morally unjustifiable. Because in a sense, what are we saying? Are we willing to lock people up for crimes they have not committed? Are we willing to say that that's the kind of society we want? Jules and I think not. And he's going to finish up now.
We have attempted to address several major concerns we have about psychologists participating in SVP evaluations on behalf of the state. Let me summarize them briefly. The first concern is that SVP civil commitment clearly serves as a form of preventive detention, which we believe constitutes double jeopardy. That is, first you do your time in prison, and most of the people we've seen somewhere between 5 and 25 years, and then rather than providing you with treatment while you were doing your sentence, which might make some sense, we will wait until you think you're about to get out, and now we'll punish you again by civilly committing you for an indefinite amount of time. It doesn't seem to us that psychologists should be involved in supporting the state in doing this to one particular set of criminal offenders. Second, SVP commitments are based on what I've referred to as fictitious or tortured assertions of mental disorders and abnormalities that single out sex offenders to demonize. No one, to our knowledge, has recommended a physically violent predator statute for men who brutally assault the bodies of women and children physically, despite the fact that the Bureau of Justice statistics indicate that 3 times as many children in this country are seriously physically abused as sexually abused. Third, SVP assessments rely heavily, as Paul just got through asserting, on actuarial tests, which are not nearly as reliable as they're asserted to be, and often ignore or minimize dynamic and protective factors. I will tell you that I'm working on a case now of a man who's done 23 years. His last rape was 23 years ago. He's 64. He's hobbling. The notion of his raping another woman seems bizarre in the extreme to me, but because his static 99 score will never change until the day he dies, he is considered by the state evaluators to constitute a high risk. Fourth, and this I'll do very quickly, it's a whole big section we don't have time for, treatment issues. First is the whole issue of involuntary treatment, the fact that people are being told you will be treated whether you wish to or not, something that's always problematic. Second is the men in these programs, mainly down at Atascadero and Coalinga State Hospitals here in California, fear that disclosure of past offenses, their urge to be totally honest about everything they've done that's illicit, they fear that disclosure for past criminal sexual offenses for which they've not been prosecuted may well result in the initiation of new criminal charges. And finally, the men here in California who have been civilly committed have learned that you are at least 10 times more likely to be released via trial than by your treating clinicians. That is, there are 130 men who have been released at trial, including 3 or 4 that Paul and I have helped to get released at trial, and only 6 to 10, none of the people I contacted at Atascadero or in the continuing outpatient programs knows the exact number, but about 6 to 10 men have been released by virtue of clinicians saying they're ready to be released to the community. So obviously there's no motive to participate in treatment. In sum, because we think our profession is at root a profession which intends to diminish human suffering and to promote health and the widest possible range and freedom of choice to the people we serve, we wish to make a plea to psychologists to consider that participating in such a broken and destructive system, which often results in depriving men of their freedom for years, is to exhibit political naivete and to engage in unethical professional conduct. We thus urge all of our colleagues to refuse to join state SVP panels in conducting such evaluations and, contrarywise, to participate in doing such evaluations only for the defense. Thank you.
One question I would have is, what ethical code sections do you feel such psychologists would be violating by testifying for the state in the SVP commitment hearings?
It's clear to us that there's no particular section of the ethical code that suggests that you would be violating professional conduct. That's why we've done this. we believe that it is unethical, despite the fact that there's no injunction by our own national organization.
I very much enjoyed this excellent presentation, and particularly the passion which you obviously have for this. I think more of this should be discussed. I think maybe next year we should have a panel with some of the representatives, shall we say, of the dark side, as you would put it.
Excellent. If they'll be here.
They'll still be there. Yes, you don't have to worry. The state will always find psychologists to do this work.
No, I mean if they agree to be here.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think it should be a program where the other side, I think with all your passion, deserves to have a voice. So we'll hear about the accuracy of the actuarial predictions and so on. But thank you very much.
I'm an attorney. I really applaud you gentlemen for what I thought was a tremendous intellectual presentation. I look at medical doctors who refuse to participate in executions by the states, and I hear your plea to psychologists not to participate in what I think are unlawful in many cases, based on the criteria, are unlawful incarcerations. I would mention a couple of things because I am on your side. Number one, the criminal justice system itself has rejected guilt by probabilities and statistics. You cannot be convicted in the criminal system in that manner. Double jeopardy does not apply, and I'm very afraid that by focusing on the double jeopardy aspect, that you will be detracting from what is the real problem, and that is the definitions of the disorders and how they are just they're built out of, it's like sculpting with water, as someone said to me earlier.
Could you say why it doesn't apply? Because it seems to us it's being punished for the same crime twice.
It does seem that way. I just have two letters and a word, O.J. Simpson. That's exactly what happened to O.J. Simpson, but nobody got up and screamed because this was a black man who got away with murder in everybody's eyes. So when they convicted him civilly and got a $90 million judgment, nobody was concerned. It was fine. I have my own opinions and all that. I think that it is a different standard of evidence, preponderance in a civil case, maybe clear and convincing in other incarceration areas. But when you look at O.J., you can see that it is not double jeopardy. It is so ingrained in the system in the court system, in the justice system. I don't think you want to undo it there. I think you need to undo it by attacking the exact areas which make it unjust. It is this creating out of whole cloth and sculpting with water. I thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Hello. I've never spoken in front of a group like this in my life, so I'm very nervous. Bear with me. I'm a psychologist with a law degree, but I'm not an attorney. But I was really kind of moved by what you had to say because this has been going on for a long time. The lesser people, the unpopular people, are always the people that are testing our constitutional rights. And I think that you were saying that. The rights that we had at one time have been abrogated quite a bit over the years. Our First Amendment rights, rights of free speech, our rights of being free from unreasonable search and seizure, Fourth Amendment rights, and our privacy rights that I can think of, and possibly our 14th Amendment rights as well, equal protection. And so here we have another group of people that are unpopular. But these people, just like the criminals that are also unpopular, these are our rights that are being eviscerated. And these are ways to ultimately eviscerate our rights. And so it's a big deal what you're talking about. And it's important to really examine these values because we're all the people under the Constitution. And you're right. The Constitution has been tortured significantly over the years. And we risk our freedoms, our fundamental freedoms, So anyway, I just wanted to, I'm talking too much, I'm sorry about that, but I really appreciate what you had to say.
Thank you very much.
I've done a number of SPV evaluations for the defense, and of course none of them have ever worked in trial. I'm curious, you mentioned 150 people got up on writs primarily, and you said three or four had gotten out actually on trial? And
no.
Can you clarify, have you actually testified?
No, we've both testified in several. Of course, in the minority of cases do we prevail. I said 130 at a point where, now it's changed in California, had a right to a trial every 2 years before their peers.
But that's
130 of those men have been released by their peers, citizens. Only 6 to 10 have been deemed by the clinicians at the state hospitals running these programs as suitable for being released to the community, typically after 5 to 6 years of treatment. That's what we said.
Can you tell me a little bit about one case, or a little bit to the group here, that you actually prevailed and how you prevailed in a trial?
I'll try to make it as brief as possible so we don't cut into the next one. Paul and I and a third colleague participated 3 years ago in the case of a man who at the time had served 19 years for his second rape, had on his own volition sought treatment, got 3 years of treatment with a clinician specializing in sex offenders at the Vacaville Medical Facility, had a license as an electrician, and everything about our clinical interview, the treatment he had, psychological testing suggested to us that there was very, very little risk that he posed to the community. I brought in posters that had to do with some of the things I've talked about today regarding fictitious mental disorders, had blow-ups of the diagnoses, particularly sexual abuse of an adult, and people said in the debriefing, we were convinced, although we don't like any sex offenders, that the state did not demonstrate to our satisfaction that this man was anything but what Dr. Burstein and Dr. Good said, a man who had for many years committed criminal acts, including rape, had not done anything for 20 years, and suffered from no mental disorder that predisposed him to rape, but had been a very bad person. That became persuasive. That's how we got him off.
I have two quick comments. How many people in this room billed?
Over. Go ahead.
How many people in this room billed $480,000 in the first 6 months of a year? You want to? Sign up at the Department of Mental Health SVP Evaluators Panel. These people are making close to $1 million a year just doing SVP cases. And the second thing is that I think is too important to overlook is that we as psychologists are spinning our wheels if we start dealing with the legal issues. The constitutionality of the law and all that stuff is irrelevant. The Supreme Court has already said this is here and it's okay. What we have to attend to is the application of the mental health issues in these cases, and that's it.
Agreed.
We really don't have any time.
Hi. Looks like I might be finally the last person here. My name is John Adam. I work for the California Department of Corrections. And talking about the public hysteria and the widening net and the possibility of losing what might seem to be a basic right, everybody should know in California you can get an R suffix for urinating in public. Now, they won't usually give that to you if it looks like you're not doing it intentionally. But if it looks like you would like to be seen by somebody, that's all it takes. And we are giving people in prison R suffixes for public urination. What does that mean? We also just passed a law where you're going to have to wear a monitor, except they can't seem to get the damn things work right, but that was just passed by the state voters for the rest of your life. You can't live within a certain number of feet of school grounds and playgrounds and public parks. So a lot of people now, they're not sure in San Diego County, if it's dozens or hundreds, now have to live in the street who were previously found guilty of sexual offenses. So, I mean, this is a widening net, and it might get to the point where you stop to take a badly needed pee and you end up with an R suffix, and then you're begging to the psychologist evaluating you, oh, miss, I didn't mean to be seen. I'm sorry it happened. So that's where it's going.
So this is an interesting topic to a lot of people. I suggest that if you want to, you could take the discussion out in the hall because we don't want to be unfair to our remaining presenters, and we've already run over.